and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the government shutdown entered its 12th day today. Meanwhile, everything from the Environmental Protection Agency to the IRS to the national parks and the Department of Homeland Security are closed. That didn't stop border guards from firing tear gas at would-be migrants, however. Next, the 2020 race for president is heating up for both parties. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren effectively announced over the weekend that she was running for president, the first of as many as two dozen Democrats thinking of making the leap. Meanwhile, Utah's new Republican Senator Mitt Romney harshly criticized President Trump in a New Year's Day op-ed in the Washington Post, and he's not the only Republican being talked about as a primary challenger to the president. Then, a new Congress is about to be sworn in, and Democrats will assume control of the House of Representatives, threatening to use their committee chairmanships to escalate the Mueller investigation and other investigations targeting the Trump administration. What does 2019 hold for Russiagate? And then, in a New Year's address, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that he was ready to meet again with President Trump at any time, and he reaffirmed his commitment to denuclearization. But Kim also warned that his country might have to pursue what he called a new way if the United States insisted on imposing new sanctions. President Trump, meanwhile, said that he welcomes another meeting. And finally, yesterday was a day Brazilian progressives had dreaded. It was Jair Bolsonaro's inauguration. Brazil's new president is very much in the mold of Donald Trump, but even more bombastic. He has said that he will, quote, rid Brazil of socialism, unquote, and would open vast portions of the Amazon rainforest to developers. President Trump tweeted to Bolsonaro, quote, the USA is with you, unquote. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the government shutdown. The shutdown entered its 12th day today, even though President Trump met with Democratic leaders in the Oval Office. Meanwhile, everything from the Environmental Protection Agency to the IRS to the national parks and the Department of Homeland Security are closed, but that didn't stop border guards from firing tear gas at would-be migrants. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Welcome back, Juan Jose.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Brian. Glad to be with you.
Juan Jose, we're recording this segment at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. We know that the president is meeting with Democratic congressional leaders at 3 p.m. So we obviously don't know how that meeting is going to play out. But what we do know is that we're on day 12 of a shutdown. Now, the longest shutdown we've ever had in history is 21 days. We're more than halfway there. So far, there have not been any talks, no talks until today. Nancy Pelosi says that she's going to pass a strong bipartisan continuing resolution tomorrow or the day after, that the White House has already said is dead on arrival. We know that Donald Trump is being intransigent in that he will not discuss a budget unless it includes money for his beautiful concrete wall. He says that this wall is necessary to keep America safe. So let's talk about the big picture.
Well, I think that what we must not lose sight of is that President Donald Trump has chose to shut the government down, to leave nearly a million working men and women, possibly without pay for an undetermined period of time that could be very long as this impasse continues. He's arguing that we need to funding $5 billion to build this concrete wall to divide Mexico and the United States because there's, you know, this huge human invasion of Central American and Mexican immigrants coming into the United States. But I think that the gravity of the situation is being lost in this situation. And we need to say that there is no invasion, that the only invasion that has ever taken place is the foreign policy of the United States invading countries in South, Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. We've created essentially a humanitarian crisis that's forcing people to escape the violence and the lack of economic opportunity. And the United States is violating its own internal immigration laws that offers political asylum protection to those individuals that make a credible claim. And we don't have millions of people that are coming to the U.S. at this point. We have a few hundred, maybe a few thousand people with very credible cases, And the president is grabbing onto that situation and claiming that there's an invasion where there is none. I mean, these are people with legitimate claims, and I don't think that ought to be used by the federal government to justify the unjustifiable, which is a shutdown that's making millions of American workers suffer and be, you know, lost in a situation where they don't know what's going to happen. So it's not just an issue of immigration, but now it's a domestic policy issue that's jeopardizing the well-being of millions of workers and their families in this country.
Juan Jose, I think your answer is extremely important because, again, immigrants are being used as a political football. And Trump is making the argument, one, the Democrats don't care about the country's security, that a wall has to be built in order to stop this invading horde. None of that is actually true. There's another part of it, which is Trump is saying he has to fulfill campaign promises. I want to listen to an audio clip from Donald Trump. We played this in the first hour when we talked about this exact issue. I want to play it again for our audience. This is Donald Trump on the campaign trail. Listen to this.
Oh, we're going to build a wall, all right. Who's going to pay for the wall? Mexico. They'll pay. You know why they'll pay? Again, these politicians are like sounding boards. Donald, what do you mean? These are people I run against. What do you mean by Mexico? They'll never pay for it. Of course they will. If I talk to them, I guarantee with them they'll never pay because they don't know how to talk.
Okay, Juan Jose, the other politicians couldn't get Mexico to pay for the wall because they don't know how to talk, but Donald Trump does know how to talk, and that's why Mexico is going to pay. But guess what? This isn't about Mexico paying for the wall because Mexico was never going to pay for the wall. This is about American taxpayers paying for this wall. Go ahead.
That is correct, Brian. Mexico will never pay for the wall. Those are not my words. Former president and one of the worst presidents Mexico, the Mexican people have ever had, Enrique Peña Nieto, said so. They will not pay for the wall, right? And so now you have this progressive president in Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who himself has said time and time again, they will not pay for the wall. So it's the American taxpayer that will have to pay for the wall. So this $5 billion in addition to the other billions of dollars that have already been earmarked for the building of this wall, they're the ones that we are the ones that have to pay for the wall, American taxpayers. And so I don't think that the American people really want to do that. I believe that what the American people want to do is to move on, you know, to address the serious economic issues that are afflicting everybody in America and not the building of a wall, especially when, you know, when we get serious about the political implications of building a wall and everything that comes with it. Look at the situation from October to where we are today. You know, there's a Central American caravan that mysteriously gets organized in Honduras and starts marching to Mexico, crossing several Central American countries, gets to Mexico, and then keeps going all the way to the U.S. border. There's untold suffering of the children, the women, the men that are coming to America. They get to the border after suffering untold humiliation and so on at the hands of law enforcement in Mexico. And then, of course, at the border, you know, the U.S. decides that this is, in fact, an invasion and that Donald Trump is telling the truth right before the midterm elections. And so what we have is that on November the 25th, we have the first serious incident where the U.S. paramilitary forces or the Border Patrol take it upon themselves to fire tear gas, you know, at immigrants hurting women and children to prevent what Donald Trump terms a human invasion by hordes of immigrants.
Juan Jose, we just have 1 minute left, but this happened again yesterday.
This happened again yesterday. It's a violation of international law, of the sovereignty of Mexico. This is getting very, very serious. Two children just died, Central American children, in December. Things are getting out of control. We have a serious humanitarian crisis, and the way to solve it is not by building a concrete wall, and least of all, giving Donald Trump $5 billion to build it when we have 800,000 workers, American workers, who are out of a job right now, you know, without any solution in sight for their unemployment.
That was the voice of Juan Jose Gutierrez. He joined us from Los Angeles. He is the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The 2020 race for president is heating up for both parties. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren effectively announced over the weekend that she was running for president, the first of as many as 24 Democrats thinking of making the leap. Meanwhile, Utah's new Republican Senator Mitt Romney harshly criticized President Trump in a New Year's Day op-ed in the Washington Post, and he's not the only Republican being talked about as a primary challenger to the president. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Good to have you, Walter.
Happy to be here.
Walter, let's start with the Democrats. Elizabeth Warren has essentially announced that she was running. What she actually announced was that she was forming a presidential exploratory committee, which is something that's necessary because of U.S. election law before officially announcing. And she immediately, like within hours of the announcement, flew to Iowa. So she's running. She's the first one that has announced. Joe Biden's made it pretty clear that he's running too. And then another 20, 22 people have hinted that they're running as well. What do you make of Elizabeth Warren being the first to jump into this? Did she do it for the fundraising? Did she do it for the easy press? Why be the first?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of all of those factors. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren, she sort of created this image of herself as this, you know, like progressive left-wing person who's going to fight for the common person against Wall Street. But, you know, she's stumbled a lot. I think a lot of people are questioning her progressive credentials. There's the whole fiasco about her, you know, 7 to 10 generations back having a Native American relative that went very poorly for her. So I think she went to reassert control over the narrative, get out there first and be able to sort of like more affirmatively define herself when she has a bigger share of the media spotlight.
Walter, you know, I think it would be important to talk a little bit about who Elizabeth Warren actually is. A lot of people think she's very liberal, but in fact, she's a former Republican. She switched parties in 1990s. She's an Iran war hawk. She said Iran is a significant threat to the United States. She said that all options should have been on the table. She did oppose Trump scrapping the Iran nuclear arms deal, the JCPOA. She's a strong supporter of Israel. She supported the defense spending bill, you know, that huge increase above $700 billion. She voted for that. In the case of China, during a three-day visit to Beijing, Warren claimed that U.S. policy encouraging the opening of markets in China through free trade had not been successful. She advocated against the United States having more integrated economic relationships with China, and obviously assuming basically a hardline anti-China position. So why are liberals thinking Elizabeth Warren is liberal, unless the word liberal means nothing?
It means nothing, yeah.
Okay, so maybe that's why.
Well, it's pretty amazing because, you know, as a consequence of the 2016 election, you know, one would expect the Democratic Party to maybe move to the left, right? Because, you know, there is the whole Sanders phenomenon, and then you lost the election, right, to Donald Trump. But what's happened is quite the opposite in the principal way that the Democratic Party has been organizing opposition to the Trump administration, I think, has been fundamentally to his right. There are certain issues like around healthcare, right, where they're on strictly domestic issues where they're making some concessions to the progressive wing. But I think by and large, their messaging is about their toughness when it comes to standing up for what they would term U.S. interests, what I think is more properly called U.S. hegemony all around the world, particularly against Russia and China, right? Those are the two big targets. But yeah, I think Elizabeth Warren's history and statements about Iran, about, you know, support for the military-industrial complex and these enormous giveaways to people, and about Palestine too. I mean, she basically said in 2014 when Israel last carried out just another horrific massacre in Gaza that, well, if Israel bombs schools and hospitals, it's really Hamas's fault for putting their rockets nearby, right? So parroting, you know, this line that allows the Israeli government to completely destroy civilian infrastructure in Gaza. Yeah, I mean, it's nothing that could be remotely described as progressive.
Yeah. And why would Mitt Romney jump in and as his first official act essentially, as a new United States senator, criticize a president of his own party.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's interesting in that Mitt Romney actually just like returned to politics in the first place, you know, ran for Senate in Utah and, you know, very, very easily won. You know, I think there's sort of two schools of thought. I mean, one is that Mitt Romney actually wants to, you know, still wants to be the president and is gearing up for a challenge to Donald Trump in 2020. I can't see that possibly working out because of the sustained popularity of Trump within the Republican Party, even though, you know, of course, there's many, many people who are, you know, Republican Party elites, donors, whatever, who don't like Donald Trump and think he's just sort of like embarrassing and a poor manager. But I think that, you know, the only way that could work out is if there's something truly catastrophic happens to Donald Trump or the Trump administration. The other school of thought, which I think is maybe more accurate about why Mitt Romney's doing this, is that, you know, he seeks to position himself as like the leader of the establishment opposition, the responsible opposition to Donald Trump, right? So to sort of claim that mantle by, you know, just, you know, a couple days before being sworn in as a U.S. senator, coming out with this clear statement. He wants to sort of present himself as like this great moral leader, which is pretty, I mean, when Mitt Romney was in charge of Bain Capital, I mean, like all they did was go around and buy up companies and lay off a ton of people so they could make a bunch of money.
That's literally all they did.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's pretty silly for Mitt Romney. I mean, obviously, yeah, Donald Trump is an immoral person, but like, so is Mitt Romney and pretty much all of their friends and everybody they know and their whole, you know, social class.
Walter, let's talk about other Republicans who are sort of making waves right now. John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, I guess he's former as of today or tomorrow or something like that, has made repeated trips over the last 6 months to both Iowa and New Hampshire. Jeff Flake, the now former senator from Arizona, has gone on TV, every network that'll have him, to say that somebody, anybody, should run against Donald Trump in the Republican primaries. And Ben Sasse, the senior senator from Nebraska, has said the same thing, that some Republican, not them, apparently, should step forward and run against Donald Trump. So you've got Romney talking, you've got Kasich talking, and Flake and Sasse. Do you think anybody will actually run in the primaries against Donald Trump, knowing that no one has ever defeated an incumbent president in the primaries?
Yeah, I think there would have to be a serious deepening of one or many of the scandals surrounding Donald Trump. You know, maybe if there's something about, you know, his taxes or his financial dealings or his business, you know, something that like really, truly is
something Nixonian.
Yeah, exactly. Besides that, I don't think there's any realistic chance. And, you know, whoever does run would be fiercely attacked, you know, by Trump's sort of like most, you know, diehard supporters, but also I think of other Republicans who might, you know, prefer somebody other than Trump, but figure, hey, he's the sitting president, we're not going to go against them. So, yeah, I think the likelihood of that is pretty low. I mean, it's also pretty amazing that people like John Kasich are now considered sort of like the super responsible, like moderate people.
I continually marvel over that.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure under Kasich's governorship, Ohio passed one of those like fetal heartbeat laws, right?
I mean, just more than once.
Yeah, just like fanatical anti-choice, anti-woman measures. So yeah, it's like, yeah, it's weird on a number of levels.
I want to go back to Mitt Romney's op-ed today in the Washington Post attacking Trump. Listen to his actual words, and then Walter, I want you to get the comment. It is not that all of the president's policies have been misguided. He was right to align U.S. corporate taxes with those of global competitors, meaning tax giveaway to the rich. He was right to strip out excessive regulations, to crack down on China's unfair trade practices, to reform criminal justice and to appoint conservative judges. These are policies mainstream Republicans have promoted for years. But policies and appointments are only a part of the presidency. This is the part I love most. To a great degree, a presidency shapes the public character of the nation. A president should unite us and inspire us to follow our better angels. That's what Trump is not doing. He gives money, all of the taxpayers' money, to the ultra rich. He's cracking down on China. He's got a foreign policy that's aggressive, that's militarist, that's warlike. Romney doesn't say anything about the immigrants at the border, but he's not allowing the nation to do as it always has done, Walter, where the president unites us behind are better angels. I mean, this is the kind of nonsense, ridiculous American exceptionalist propaganda about how wonderful Americans were until Donald Trump came along.
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, you could go through, you know, I think literally every president talk about, you know, the war crimes, the terrible. I mean, until, you know, 1865, there was slavery in the United States.
George W. Bush helped us follow our better angels right into Baghdad, John, and overthrew a sovereign government.
That's right. And never batted an eye.
And then, I mean, we could really go through all that. I mean, Barack Obama with the kill lists and the drone assassination program and lots of other stuff too. Bill Clinton, I don't know if he made us follow our better angels. I mean, they kicked millions of kids off of food stamps, right? Off of welfare.
Bombed Yugoslavia, ignored genocide in Rwanda.
But I can just see the kids in Yemen when their village is being hit by U.S. drones up in the sky that they don't say they must think there's those better angels. We can't see them, but they're dropping bombs on us again.
Yeah.
I mean, what nonsense.
They hate the terrorists, but not us. We'll have to leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A new Congress is about to be sworn in tomorrow, and Democrats will assume control of the House of Representatives, threatening to use their new committee chairmanships to escalate the Mueller investigation and other investigations targeting the Trump administration. What does 2019 hold for Russiagate? We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it's as though, Daniel, there's so little that we know and still so much that we know or can expect to happen. One of those things we can certainly expect is a whole lot of investigations, beginning with the House Intelligence Committee and probably expanding to at least the House Judiciary Committee. What can you tell us at these early stages? What should we expect in the coming weeks with Congress, the new Congress coming in tomorrow?
I think the way this whole investigative process works is that a House committee can keep the ball rolling for indefinitely, months, if not years. I mean, nothing solid has turned up about collusion in the Russiagate story. Yet the story keeps on going. A new tidbit is put out every week. And so the scandal keeps somehow perpetuating itself. And even though there's less and less of substance that's coming out. So I expect that'll be the pattern for the next few months. And I expect that the Democrats will rev this whole process up to make it sort of seem as if there really is an avalanche of information crashing down on Trump when there really isn't.
I have to agree. Aaron Maté of The Real News published a piece in The Nation just a few days ago in which he lays it out, and he probably doesn't mean to be funny, but it came off as funny to me. He says here, headlines warn that Russian trolls have tried to suppress the African-American vote, promote Green Party candidate Jill Stein, recruit assets and sow discord, or hack the 2016 elections via sex toy ads and Pokemon Go. Is that really what we've come to?
I think he was trying to be funny.
But it's true, though.
And also, all that Aaron Maté's article should be read by everybody.
It's outstanding.
It's the best, I think, the best single summary, because it's hard to keep track of all of the Russiagate stuff. But it's the best single summary of why there is, at least so far, no there. And also goes on to explain, and all the things that you just mentioned,
yep,
all of them came from the report from the organization New Knowledge, which is a Democratic Party hit job that was funded by Democratic Party billionaire Reid Hoffman in part. He was the founder of LinkedIn. They themselves created false flag operations, those are their own words, to intervene in the Alabama Senate race. And then when they were exposed, the New York Times reporter, who knew in advance about what they were doing, said it was just an experiment to imitate Russian tactics. They're the ones who are coming up with all of these outlandish stories. Again, they're part of a Democratic Party covert ops. That's what they really are. Anyway, everybody should read Aaron Maté's article in The Nation. Excellent, excellent piece.
Yeah, it was very, very good. But the point that Aaron made is that the alleged Russian intervention in the 2016 election involved minuscule amounts of money and involved also juvenile and absurd advertisements. that only a small fraction of which were even overtly political, even related to the presidential race. So the effort was so minute, so juvenile, so absurd that it's impossible to imagine it had any effect at all, any measurable effect at all on the outcome of that race.
Yeah. We know that Adam Schiff is the chairperson of the House Intelligence Committee, now that the Democrats have the majority, is going to focus on Russia and Russian investigations. He's also going to focus on China, on North Korea, again on Saudi Arabia. I think it'll be the least of it, actually. But what he's focusing on is what they call authoritarianism. They link Trump and the Trump administration to all of these other negative authoritarian projects around the world, like China, like Russia, like North Korea. But if anything, Daniel, it seems to me that we can see that the Democrats are moving into the new Cold War mentality and approach that's going to be overarching. It's not going to simply be about Russian collusion. It's going to be a new foreign policy, or the attempt to solidify a new foreign policy targeting North Korea, which Trump says he wants to have peace with, targeting China, which Trump has made a big deal in terms of having a confrontational stance, but also says he wants to make a deal, and against Russia. This is part of, I would say, a dangerous move by the Democratic Party in the direction of war and militarism, where the House Intelligence Committee, using its investigative tools, will actually just be part of that bigger project.
Totally, totally. I mean, first of all, the Democrats are now the party of war. This is why people like Max Boot, the neocon commentator, are now Democrats. The funny thing is, the Republicans under Trump have gotten too peaceful for him. It's hard to believe, but it's true. And secondly, we saw this we've seen this so far in Syria, where Trump is trying to pull out, and Congress en masse is mobilizing against him, but in which Democrats are playing an especially prominent role. I mean, Pelosi blasted Trump's attempt to withdraw from Syria as, quote, a Christmas gift for Putin. So the Democrats are now evolving into a highly militant, bellicose, pro-war stance. And this is the rationale, the raison d'etre behind Russiagate. They're trying to maneuver Trump into hostilities with Russia, China, North Korea, etc. I mean, this is just a kind of, it's foreign policy by subterfuge.
Yeah, Adam Schiff wants Trump's Deutsche Bank records to find out if president is compromised by Russian money laundering. That's a big headline in Newsweek. And Democrats look to hire staff to help investigate Donald Trump in the new year. Daniel Lazar, you know what? If you want to find a way to reach people in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, the so-called battleground states, who, because Trump won them narrowly, gave Trump the presidency. If you want to reach those people, you should be talking about something other than this stuff. And yet it seems that, like, this is the main arrow in the quiver for the Democrats.
And let me add something to that, too. You're right. This is a major political arrow in the Democratic quiver. But the truth is that nothing ever comes of these investigations because they have no teeth. When I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff, the first investigation that I conducted was one in international piracy. And so did a lot of work. We got Captain Phillips, the famed Captain Phillips, to come and testify. We made the cover of Time magazine, the cover of People magazine, even. When the hearing was all done, I had put my investigation on paper. We submitted it to the State Department. And I said to John Kerry, so what next? He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, we did the investigation. We did the hearing. So now what happens? He said, nothing. We're done.
It's about headlines.
And that's it.
It's taking, I mean, the government is shut down, and yet we still pay Congress people to hold hearings so that they can have self-serving political promotion headlines. That's really what it's about, in addition to this new right-wing Cold War policy.
It's about keeping 2,000 troops in Syria as well, and, you know, and getting Americans' heads blown off in Afghanistan, all of which the Democrats want to do. The whole thing is just so, it's backdoor government, backroom government of the worst kind.
Yeah, and also it would be so awful if the United States government had a negotiated agreement with, and I'm putting Schiff's words in air quotes here, authoritarian North Korea. Well, you can call North Korea names all the way to the bank, but the bottom line is that if you don't have a negotiation with North Korea, if instead you decide to opt for war, you can call the North Korean government anything you want, but the bottom line is it's going to be North Korean people who are deprived food and medicine, or if there's a conflict, they'll lose their lives and the lives of their children and their neighbors as they did during the Korean War between 1950 and 53.
Listen, Adam Schiff is one of the most dutiful servants of the American military industrial complex. He backs the arms makers. He's backed every major war, the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera. He cheered on the war in Yemen. And until very recently, he was a very good friend of the Saudis. Now he's sort of seen the light and he's changed his stance on the Saudis, but otherwise he is the same neocon, battle-hardened neocon that we've always known. So the point is, you know, this war against Trump, this war against authoritarianism is totally nonsense. It's misleading. It's smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, I have to tell you, John, I agree with Daniel. I feel like Saudi Arabia in a way has been thrown into the mix because every time people were the Democrats were attacking North Korea and China and Russia, people would say, well, what about Israel's human rights record? What about Saudi Arabia? Well, they can't go after Israel because that's off the table right. for all politicians. Right. So you can throw in Saudi Arabia now to look like you're a little bit even-handed. But this isn't going to be about Saudi Arabia.
No.
This is a war, a propaganda war against Russia and China and North Korea at the same time as the Pentagon has reorganized its military doctrine to target these exact countries for military confrontation.
Absolutely right. We're out of time, unfortunately. We were very pleased to be joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In a New Year's address, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that he was ready to meet again with President Trump at any time, and he reaffirmed his commitment to denuclearization. But Kim also warned that his country might have to pursue what he called, quote, a new way, close quote, if the United States insisted on imposing or maintaining economic sanctions. President Trump, meanwhile, said that he welcomes another meeting. We're joined from Philadelphia by Hyun Lee. Hyun is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. She is also a writer for zoominkorea.org. Hyun Lee, welcome back.
Hi, Happy New Year.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you, and thank you for joining us once again. Because it's the new year, and because it's January 2nd, we know that almost every January 1st, the leadership in North Korea makes an address. And these speeches are important. We certainly thought the speech last year was extremely important and a sign of what was coming in 2018. Anyway, what's your big takeaway from Kim Jong-un's New Year address?
Yeah, for me, the most striking thing, I think, was that, you know, the U.S. media is focusing exclusively on what Kim Jong-un said about the nuclear talks with the U.S. But when you look at the actual speech, that part was maybe just 1 to 2 paragraphs of the entire speech. And the majority of the speech was focused on building a self-reliant economy and continuing to improve North-South relations. And Kim Jong-un proposed 2 slogans to the people of North Korea, which is, you know, like the banner that will guide the entire society this year. One of them was, let us open a new road of advance for socialist construction under the uplifted banner of self-reliance. And then the second one was, quote, let us usher in a heyday of peace, prosperity, and reunification of the Korean Peninsula by thoroughly implementing the historic North-South declarations. I think it's clear from Kim Jong-un's speech that the economy and inter-Korean relations will be the main priorities for North Korea this year.
That's the voice of Hyun Lee. She's a writer for Zoom in Korea. extremely important, John, and why I think it's extremely important for us to have guests like Hyun Lee and to do this segment. Because guess what, everybody? If you're only reading the U.S. corporate-owned media, you won't actually understand what the North Koreans are thinking, what they're saying, what they're signaling as they are consciously, conspicuously in the New Year's address. Again, because the American media is American-centric, it's also racist, it's colonialist, and it makes it appear to Americans that everything that North Koreans are saying has to do with how they view America. And clearly, as Hyun Lee is saying, what the North Koreans are signaling by this speech is that their focus isn't really so much America, it's Korea and Koreans, not just Koreans in the North, but Koreans in the South and their relations. I want to read one line to you, Hyun Lee, from Kim Jong-un's address and ask you to comment on it. Last year, all the people further consolidated the foundations of the self-supporting economy by turning out in the struggle for carrying out the party's new strategic line of concentrating all efforts on economic construction. That just jumped out at me, especially given the fact that Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, the slogan at that time was Army First. Here you have Kim Jong-un saying, concentrating all efforts on economic construction. That's the priority. Yeah. That is the priority of the Kim Jong-un government. Go ahead.
So just a little historical background for the former leader, Kim Jong-il. He was facing a world where the former Soviet Union had collapsed. There was no more socialist trading bloc. The country was facing an economic crisis, especially in light of intensified U.S. sanctions as well. And so at that time, North Korea felt that building up its defense was the number one priority. And for North Korea, when they said military first, it was, of course, building up national defense as a priority. But also, it also meant that the army played a very significant role in the construction of its economy. So it was the military in North Korea that actually rebuilt factories, built the dams, irrigated canals for agriculture. And so military first has actually a deeper meaning than just defense first. And then we come to last year's New Year's speech by the new leader, Kim Jong-un. North Korea was feeling confident that it had completed some very successful nuclear and missile test launches, and that they determined that their nuclear weapons program was successful enough as a successful deterrent for their country against, namely, U.S. Nuclear threats. And so having completed their nuclear weapons program, North Korea felt they were confident to shift their national focus to really focusing on building their economy. And this is something not necessarily new. They have been, since the economic crisis of the mid-1990s to early 2000s, they have been pursuing what's called a Pyongjin line, which is two parallel tracks, pursuing its nuclear weapons program for deterrence, and then also pursuing a self-reliant economic development model. And now I think they're signaling that they are ready to go full speed ahead in focusing on their economy.
Hyun, what is the U.S. policy community saying about this speech? Do you think that with Donald Trump's comments afterwards that he looks forward to another meeting, that will happen in the near future?
Well, I think it really depends on whether or not the U.S. is willing to accept North Korea's proposal of taking mutual steps towards building a quote-unquote new relationship, which is what they had agreed to in the Singapore summit. I think it's clear that there are competing agendas in Washington. I think Trump's instinct is to take bold action here. And there are several factors that are driving this. I think number one, he wants to be able to say, I achieved something that Obama wasn't able to do in Korea. Two, I think he wants to resolve the nuclear issue with Kim Jong-un so that he can focus on the bigger fish, which is his competition with China. Plus, he doesn't care so much about the U.S. alliance with South Korea. In fact, he thinks the U.S. is getting the short end of the stick and that South Korea should be paying much more for U.S. troops in South Korea. Those negotiations are happening right now and are basically deadlocked because Trump is demanding that Moon Jae-in pay much more for U.S. troops stationed in South Korea, a demand that Moon Jae-in cannot meet because his economy is not doing so well either. At the same time, Trump's instincts are, he is stymied by other people in his administration who basically represent the interests of the military-industrial complex. They worry that implementing the Singapore Declaration, which promises lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula, will mean an eventual withdrawal of U.S. troops, which is bad for business, for the weapons contractors. I think this is the main reason that the talks have stalled since Singapore. And in his speech, Kim Jong-un is basically saying to Trump, you know, it's time. You have to make a decision already. Which way are you going to go? And I think there might be two indicators that from the Trump administration on whether or not a second summit will take place. One is the issue of sanctions. North Korea has been saying that sanctions is one concrete step that the U.S. removing or lifting the sanctions is one concrete step that the U.S. can take to signal that it is willing to build, move towards a different kind of a relationship. And then the second thing is the key resolve full legal exercises, the huge war games that usually happen in the earlier part of the year, usually begins at the end of February, early March, goes through April. And if the U.S. was willing to put on hold another massive war exercise back in August of last year after the Singapore summit to give the talks an opportunity to progress, whether or not the U.S. is willing to do the same for the full legal exercises in February, I think will be another indicator whether or not the U.S. is serious about having another summit and giving this a real try to see if the talks can succeed.
Yes, Kim Jong-un, we have about a minute and a half left, Hyun Lee. Kim Jong-un had made it clear to the Trump administration, as you're pointing out, you have to decide. If you impose new sanctions, then the plans for the eventual denuclearization and long-lasting peace between the U.S. and North Korea, at least from the DPRK's point of view, will be put on hold because, as the Singapore summit says, the point number one is to improve relations. You can't do that and sanction North Korea and try to destroy the country. Back in December, just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. imposed new sanctions on three top North Korean officials, including a top advisor to Kim Jong-un. His name is Cho Ryong-hae, a close advisor to Kim Jong-un, and seen as the second-ranking official in the government, according to USA Today. Talk about mixed signals. You can't be more mixed than saying, yeah, we want peace with North Korea and then sanction the negotiators.
That's right. I mean, I think the U.S. has to come to terms with the fact that the only way to resolve a nuclear threat is through a political solution. I mean, when we look at history, how did the U.S. resolve the nuclear threat from countries that were formerly perceived as enemies? And I'm not talking about countries that were in the developing stage like Iran or Libya, but countries that actually possessed nuclear weapons like China. You know, it wasn't through a military option or sanctioning them to collapse. It was by establishing normal diplomatic relations. And I think resolving the North Korean nuclear threat will require ending the state of war and moving towards normal relations. And I think sanctions so far have been the U.S. main weapon of pressure against North Korea. And it is also the main obstacle that's in the way of North-South cooperation. So I think ending sanctions would be one of the first concrete steps for the U.S. to move toward or to actually signal that it is willing to move towards building a new relationship that is based on trust.
That's Hyun Lee. Hyun is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. She is a writer for zoominkorea.org. I urge everyone, go to zoominkorea.org, read their material, support that website. Invaluable to understand what's really going on in Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Yesterday was a day Brazilian progressives had dreaded. It was Jair Bolsonaro's inauguration. Brazil's new president is very much in the mold of Donald Trump, but even more bombastic. He has said that he will, quote, rid Brazil of socialism, unquote, and would open vast portions of the Amazon rainforest to developers. Among other things, President Trump tweeted to Bolsonaro, quote, the USA is with you, exclamation point, unquote. We're joined from Caracas, Venezuela by Aline Piva. She is a journalist and member of the Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. Aline, welcome back.
Thank you.
I have to say, I read Bolsonaro's inauguration speech, and he made the obligatory call for unity, and then he offered nothing in the way of promoting unity. Do you think that this administration is going to be as bad as so many of us have said or said during the campaign? Is there anything positive that we could be looking toward?
Hardly. I think he made it very clear in his inaugural speech. And, you know, it was a very telling speech because usually presidents use that speech, both the public speech and the speech in the House of Representatives, to give the guidelines, you know, of how public policy is going to be made for the coming years. And what he said was exactly the same thing that he was saying in the campaign trail, right? What he wants to do is to eliminate all dissent and just open up the country for big business. You know, his first act as president, you know, the very first act was to give the rights for to set boundaries of traditional indigenous and black community lands to agribusiness. It's something that is, it's unprecedented and it's very, very scary.
You know, there are things too, Brian, besides the rainforest, for example, or this political preoccupation with the progressive left in Brazil. There are things like relations with Israel, for example. Benjamin Netanyahu was one of the few chiefs of state who actually went to the inauguration. The United States sent Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, but Benjamin Netanyahu himself went and lauded the fact that Bolsonaro had been elected president of Brazil and said that he was looking forward to many years of a close relationship with Brazil. Now, at the same time, Bolsonaro told a reporter yesterday, just after the inauguration, how much he admired Benjamin Netanyahu. Why? Because he said Netanyahu was able to promote companies that raised fish in the desert. What the heck do we make out of that, other than it was just a throwaway as something to convince people that strengthening, closening relationship with Israel is a good thing and it's going to happen and there's nothing anybody can do about it? Go ahead, Aline.
You know, yesterday when you saw the pictures of people who attend the inauguration, you saw two things that also very telling: the United States flag and the Israel's flag. They were both there. During the campaign, this whole Israel thing was brought up as something to, you know, as a symbol of nationalism. It's not something new. We saw this happening in European countries as well, such as, I don't know, Hungary and people and places where there is a rise of fascism. But it's very, you know, it's interesting to see how people in Brazil are buying this narrative. And they are thinking, yes, it's okay. What this technology that Bolsonaro claims is going to import from Israel, we have been using this for decades now in the northeast of the country. It's nothing new. It's nothing that we don't have. But they sell it as something that is, you know, has a nationalist approach to it. I don't know. It's a very, you know, it's a crazy narrative that everyone's buying into it.
So why are they promoting this now? What is it about Israel that is so appealing to the right wing of Brazilian politics?
I think it's that this is the, you know, the one state discourse, you know, fighting tooth and nail to have, you know, their land and everything. Of course, we know this is not the reality. You know, we know that the suffering that this is, they are imposing to the Palestinian people, you know, they everything that they do, you know, the violations of human rights, but they are talking to a crowd that willingly, that they are willing to give up human rights, basic human rights, in the name of something they don't even understand exactly how it works. You know, for example, when Bolsonaro says yesterday at his inaugural speech, he said he was going to fight political correctness. I mean, what does it mean?
Right. What is that supposed to mean? Like, nobody's ever thought of that before.
Bolsonaro said, not yesterday, but before, he's, quote, "I am in favor of torture. You know that. And the people are in favor of it, too." Now, this is somebody who admires the old Brazilian military dictatorship.
Yes.
That regularly employed torture. In April 2016, when Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff's impeachment was put to a vote in Congress, Bolsonaro dedicated his vote to a colonel who ran a torture center during the country's military dictatorship, in which Ms. Rousseff was tortured in her youth. So she's tortured as a freedom fighter. And he dedicates his vote for impeachment to the memory of Colonel Carlos Alberto Briahante Ustra, the terror of Dilma Rousseff. I vote yes. That's Bolsonaro. After, in a 1990 interview, Bolsonaro said, "There is no doubt I would perform a coup on the same day Congress doesn't work. And I am sure that at least 90% of the population would celebrate and applaud because it doesn't work. The Congress today is useless. Let's do the coup already. Let's go straight to the dictatorship," close quote, 1999 interview. In the same interview, he said, "Elections won't change anything in this country. Unfortunately, it will only change on the day we break out in civil war here and do the job that the military regime didn't do, killing 30,000. If some innocent people die, that's fine. In every war, innocent people die. I will be happy if I die, as long as 30,000 others go with me." This is the guy
Sick.
Who is the new president of Brazil, who Donald Trump likes, and who, not surprisingly, Benjamin Netanyahu loves.
Yeah, exactly. So during the campaign, he said that one of the, with all that discourse, that narrative, he also said that the problem in Brazil was that we needed conciliation. We had a country that was divided by, you know, the Workers' Party politics. And what he does is exactly the opposite. You know, he says we need conciliation, but at the same time, what he's doing is giving a carte blanche for people just go ahead and kill people on the streets. You know, the amount of news that we are getting of people being beaten down on the streets. Just a couple of days ago, there was one gay couple walking down the streets in São Paulo, and they were brutally murdered, you know, at knife point, just because they were walking holding hands. So this is something. That's the problem with Bolsonaro. You know, during the military dictatorship, the state was doing all the violence. But now, what Bolsonaro is doing is carte blanche so we can have anyone on the streets doing justice by their own hands. And this is very, very dangerous.
And the same thing is happening in the Philippines. And the Filipino people, by and large, have just sort of adapted to it. Do you see that happening in Brazil?
Not the majority. I think this is something very interesting because there was also, alongside with that narrative, you know, that very extremist narrative, there was also the narrative of corruption. And now it's very open that his whole cabinet, Bolsonaro's cabinet, it's extremely corrupted. I think they're part of the people who is kind of waking up, you know, of this trance, because I think that what happened in Brazil was not short of, you know, a collective trance or something like this. You know, people were very manipulated. But there are also part of the people who still endorse the narrative and says, you know, human rights for right humans, you know, and things like, yeah, we should kill them all and exterminate them all. So there are two things going on at the same time.
Yeah, and you can, you know, the scent, the smell of fascism in the air, actually, again.
Real fascism.
As Aline is describing it. Final point, Aline, we have about 40 seconds left. I'm looking at a headline in Yahoo. Pompeo, Brazil foreign minister, now under Bolsonaro, discussed democracy support for Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has discussed with Brazil's new foreign minister how they could support the people of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, quote, in restoring their democratic governance and their human rights, close quote. Anyway, 30 seconds left. Take us out.
So we are looking to a government that was illegitimate, elected, talking about, you know, restore democracy in other countries. We are looking at a government that is going to do anything to please U.S. interests in the region. I don't think we are looking to a direct intervention, but yes, now the U.S. has a great, you know, a huge ally in that campaign against what they say is the tree of tyranny. I'm not sure what they call Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Caracas, Venezuela by Aline Piva. She is a journalist and a member of Brazilians for Democracy and Social Justice. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.